Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Radio Networks on Sunday, March 3rd, 2013. This is episode 958. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast brought to you by Hover.com. Hover is a reliable domain name registration and management service that's simple, honest, and easy to use. For exceptional customer support and 10% off your new domain name, go to Hover.com/TechGuy and use the offer code TechGuy. And by RingCentral. I love my cloud-based phone system from RingCentral. Zero startup costs. And RingCentral is $20 per month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial. And when you buy one desk phone, you'll get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. And it's time to talk about technology, computers, you know, and the internet. Yeah, of course, but cell phones, home theater. You know, the stuff that's both changing our world for fun and for profit, for work and for play. And that's what I talk about on the show each and every weekend. I hope you will join me. Chris Marquardt, our photographic mythbuster, will come by at half past the second hour to talk. I see he's in the chat room already. The phone number, if you want to call, make a comment, ask a question, is 8888-ASK-LEO. We do that so it's easy to remember. 8888-ASK-LEO, but if you want the digits, it's 888-827-5536. That's toll-free from anywhere in the U.S., outside the U.S., you could still reach us. Just use a Skype or some other, voice over internet solution, and all will be free and well. Let's see. Oh, there's a great website. If I do say so myself, techguylabs.com. We invite you to visit there. I have to, it's maybe too early to eat my hat, but maybe I'll start salting it and maybe putting a little hot sauce on it, just in case. I think somebody ate one of my hats because it's gone. Maybe I ate it in my sleep. That's what that giant marshmallow was. And I say that in context with Windows 8. We talked a lot about Windows 8, and I have to say, initially my reaction was I'm going to hold off and give it a chance, because while it looks so different and in many ways ungainly, I have to think that Microsoft's spent a lot more time thinking about it than I did, and there's a reason why it is the way that it is, and perhaps if I just give it a chance. And I got a Surface RT, the tablet version of Windows 8, and it was okay. I thought, this is cool, this is neat, but not for me. Not for me. I'm going to stick with my iPad, my Android tablets, my Macintosh. But I didn't give up. We had a call, you may remember it, a couple of weeks ago. A woman asked me about the new Skype on Windows 8, and I had to say, I'm a bad man. I haven't really played with Windows 8 Pro, the desktop Windows 8, too much. I played with it a little bit, so I finally went out and I said, all right, I'm going to get a Windows 8 computer, a laptop, and I'm going to give it some time. And you know me, I like nicely made stuff. I was underwhelmed by the Surface, so I didn't want the Surface Pro. I wanted to give Windows 8 a chance with something really nice. And I looked around. I was waiting for the Lenovo X1 Carbon Touch. That sounded like a really nice system. Expensive, about $1,300 to $1,400, but perhaps worth it. And I'm willing to spend the money to get something to give Windows 8 the full chance. And then my friend Father Robert Ballister, who is a geek and a priest. They are not mutually exclusive, much to my surprise. I thought, oh, well, he won't. He's like, he hosts our podcast called This Week in Enterprise Tech. he's like more geeky than I am. But he brought by his Acer S7 Ultrabook. And wow, I thought that is beautiful. It's white. It's kind of creamy, very light, less than 3 pounds. Just beautiful. And features something that I think all Windows 8 computers should have, a touch screen. I've tried a few without a touchscreen, and it's clear to me that while, yes, you may want to use the keyboard and mouse, as you have for years with Windows, that the ability to reach out and touch the screen sometimes is just, it just makes sense, especially with Windows 8, which was designed for touch. And so I bought this Acer S7. Not cheap. It's not an inexpensive Ultrabook. I think the one I got with a i5 processor. I'm sorry, i7. Top of the line Intel processor and 256 gig solid state drive, 13 inch screen that is a very high resolution. It's 1920 by 1080. Touch, yes. And after all of that and spending about a week now with it, I fell in love with the hardware right away. There's some negatives. You know, the keyboard isn't as beautiful as I would like. The screen is stunning. I mean, I think the screen is really where it shines. The keyboard's not great. It only has 4 gigs of RAM and you can't put more in it. I thought that's kind of odd. But after I played with it a little bit, I started to think, you know, this isn't so bad. I'm not ready to eat my hat yet, but, with the right hardware, I think Windows 8, it still is a big learning curve. The idea that you have to swipe stuff in from the edges. For instance, I asked my friend Paul Thurrott, who's a Windows expert. I said, well, I want to close applications. I can't figure out. I'm in a Metro application. I cannot figure out. He said, well, that's easy. You swipe down from the top until it disappears. What? That wasn't immediately obvious. And it's not like computers these days come with manuals anymore, do they? So that was a revelation. Although I have to say, sometimes I do that and the stuff doesn't stay closed, so I don't really understand. You know, really the truth of it is Windows 8, like most smartphones these days, it's really, they say, don't worry about it. We'll close the program when you're done. You know, just let stuff run. And it's all, and a lot of it's full screen. A lot of the Metro apps take up the whole screen. And that takes a little getting used to. But I wanted to give it a chance, and having given it a little bit of a chance, I have to say I'm somewhat impressed by it, especially because I love the hardware so much. And somebody in the chat room the other day said, oh, well, of course, Leo's a hardware guy. And I don't know if that – I never thought of myself as that. I think of it as a holistic system, but this is pretty nice. So much so that I've taken to taking it home, and I've actually started to use it as my full-time work computer, my show computer. So now I should tell you that sitting in front of me right now as I do the show, I have the new Apple iMac, which is beautiful thin. I have an iPad, the big one. I have the little one at home, the mini. I have the Windows 8 S7 tablet. I have an old XP, Windows XP tablet that I use for the call screening, and an Android phone and an iPhone. So... I'm not the kind of guy that, I don't want to get in these religious wars over platforms, but I want to be able to give you good advice about what you should do. And I think if you're used to Windows 7 or earlier versions of Windows, Windows 8 is a big step in UI, whether it's a step forward or backwards. It's hard to say. For some, I think it is a step backwards. And there certainly are rough edges that Microsoft's got to polish. Reminds me a little bit, and I hate to make this comparison, of Windows Vista. Where underlying technology under the hood was a big improvement over XP, but it didn't feel right until Windows 7, which is essentially a polished version of Windows Vista. I bet you there'll be a polished version of Windows 8 that might make it a little bit more palatable. Whether that's what some are calling Windows Blue, which will be the first service pack. Microsoft really wants to make this update every year. Like they look at Apple and they say, wow, look how well Apple does with a yearly operating system update. So I think they're going to move to that yearly cycle, which means Blue will be out sometime this year, probably the fall. Not Windows 9. I don't know what Windows 9 even what might be like. I think there'll be minor upgrades to this, kind of like Apple has done with Leopard, then Snow Leopard, Lion, then Mountain Lion. Every other year is kind of a polishing year. And I think add a little polish to Windows 8 and maybe it will be the way to go. My advice, if people ask me, I say, well, if you can hold off, stick with what you've got until the fall. There'll be new laptops based on a new Intel chip design called Haswell that will have much better battery life than the current crop. This is only about 5 hours. Wouldn't you love a 10? It should be 10. And I guess you can get an extended battery, but then that eliminates the whole point of the thin light, you know. But Haswell might get us up to 10. It'd probably be a 50 to 100% increase in battery life and performance. Not such a significant, but somewhat of an increase in performance. So maybe if you can wait till Haswell comes out in June, the ultra low power parts probably shortly thereafter. Wait till the fall. Maybe a little polishing with Windows Blue, and hey, you might have something. Let's go to the phones. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Swiper, no swiping. Swiper, no swiping. Swiper, no swiping.
Oh, man.
I'd say swipe. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888, ask Leo. We were talking about Windows 8, but you know, there's other news. There's lots of it. We got new smartphones coming. The Mobile World Congress was this week. And we see Galaxy S4 will be announced March 15th. Samsung admits that, the sequel to its very popular Galaxy S3. I'm a fan. Can't wait to see the S4. And HTC, a couple of weeks ago, announced, and it will be available March 15th. Not the Galaxy S4 will just be announced, not available probably for another month. But available March 15th, the HTC One on AT&T, Sprint, and T-Mobile. And this is a very nice Android device. Kind of just, they decided to compete with the iPhone in terms of manufacture, all unibody aluminum, things like that. Wow. Tough choices out there. But choice is good, in my opinion. I know it's confusing. And there are those who say, oh, I don't want choice. Just tell me what to buy. A lot of us feel that way. And often that means, I don't want choice. Apple, tell me what to buy. But in truth, I think choice is good for everybody. And there is a lot of it. There's a lot of it. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number. I can answer questions about what smartphone, what operating system, what computer. We could talk about the Evernote password problem. Did you see that? Evernote got hacked, and they're making everybody who uses this very cool program, which I've, you know, proselytized for years and put on every device. It's on everything I use. They say you got to change your password. And we could talk about that. 8888 Ask Leo, and I'll tell you why 4chan, what 4chan, WikiLeaks, and Metallica.com have in common. that's a tease. But let's get to the phones right now. Judy's our first caller of the day in San Jose. Hi, Judy. I didn't push your button. Hold on, Judy. Let me push your button. See how that helps. Hey, Judy.
Hello. How are you today, Leo?
I'm wonderful. How are you?
I'm about to have my 63rd birthday in a couple days.
Happy birthday. That's wonderful. Are you going to buy yourself a treat?
Oh, I don't know. Right now my treat is I bought a Windows 8 machine back in December because it was great price.
Yeah.
And was doing fine, you know, getting used to it and living on the desktop, not on Metro.
Yeah, a lot of people like the desktop because that's what Windows 7 looked like. And so they just spend all their time there, and I don't blame you.
Yeah, and then I started having problems, crashes.
Uh-oh.
And, you know, it looks like there's something screwed up on the hard drive, but I, you know, I can't figure out what it is. And I've talked to, I bought my, do you mind if I say where I bought it?
No, not at all.
No, I bought it at Costco. Costco has this wonderful 2-year warranty on all their laptops. It's awesome. And, you know,
Well, let's see how awesome it is. Did they fix it?
No, they haven't fixed it yet.
Well, it's not awesome until they fix it.
Well, but they did. I was able to go and talk to somebody for free, and you know,
that's nice. But it's not awesome until they fix it. And if it's a brand new computer, what they should just do is say, "Oh, sorry, let's fix this for you."
Yeah. Well, I mean,
unless you feel like it was something that you installed on there, you know, as soon as you take a computer home, it's kind of like a used car, right? Then all bets are off. Who knows what has happened? And that's what the companies who make these devices will say. Well, you know what you do.
Yeah, the guy that I talked to there, you know, we finally talked about different options. And, you know, when I mentioned different geek things, he says, oh, you're a geek. You know a lot more about this stuff than most people. But he finally said, you know, you should just, you know, try setting it to factory reset. But if something screwed up the hard drive structure, will that actually fix it?
Yeah. So the factory reset is what is the default for them, because since they don't know what you've done, when you do the factory restore, it either comes on a disk, or nowadays most often it comes on a separate partition on the hard drive. When you run that restore, it puts the computer back to the way it was when you took it home. Now they can safely say, well, it's nothing Judy did. They may not, but that's what they should say. That's the point of going back to that point. Now, if you continue to have problems, then they say, well, it's our fault. We'll fix it. Now, the hard drive structure getting messed up can mean a number of things. It could be just a bad hard drive. It could also mean there was maybe a power spike and some bits got written over the hard drive. It could mean a variety of things. Usually, on a brand new computer, hard drive problems mean you've got a bad hard drive. There's an infant mortality rate on hard drives. First few months, a certain percentage are just going to not work or going to die. And that's true actually of chips, of everything. Most of the time, if something survives the first few months, then you got a year or two at least on a hard drive. And on solid-state stuff, you probably go forever before a failure. So you're in that window of, hey, it could just be a bad drive.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, do the system restore. That will overwrite it. But you want to do the thorough system restore, you know, kind of repartition, reformat the drive, rewrite everything on the drive.
Mm-hmm.
And then reset it. Now, you've got to back up your data first. Are you able to get to the drive to back up your data?
Yeah, I'm actually on a computer right now.
Oh, okay.
You know, it only happens so often, and then I lose stuff. Like, I lost a bunch of messages from Skype and stuff like that.
Yeah. And when it happens, what happens? What does it look like to you?
What
do you, stuff is just disappearing?
Yeah, I mean, I'll have a crash and then, you know.
So you get the crash. And what is the crash? When you say crash, what happens?
Okay. It reboots and it's, you know, I log back.
Bring the machine back. If a machine spontaneously reboots, it's a hardware issue. And they should.
Well, no. So I mean, they sit there and say, Windows has discovered a problem and caused it, and we're rebooting your system.
Oh, okay. So and it does. It doesn't just go, ugh. It tells you first, hey, we got a problem and we're going to reboot.
Yeah, I mean, mostly when I notice it's like I haven't been on the computer, and then I'll come back, and it will be sitting there, and it'll.
There's something wrong with the computer. They should replace it, but they understandably want to make sure it's not something you installed on it. So that's why you do the system recovery. But I can tell you right now, after you do the system recovery, you know, restore your old system, run it for a while, the same thing will start happening again. And at that point, they absolutely, you need to demand, no, this is a lemon. This is a bad computer. I want a replacement. I don't want you to fix it part by part. I paid for the extended warranty, and I want to take advantage of that.
Yeah, I don't even have to pay. I didn't have to pay for an extended warranty.
Okay.
It comes with it. But they also said that I could return it anytime within the first 90 days, and it's still within the first 90 days.
Yeah.
So
get this fixed now. You know, but don't wait. If it's day 89, take it back. But if you got a few days, you could try fixing it with the system restore. They're trying to make sure that you didn't install something that's caused. But nothing that you could install would cause this. This is a bad computer.
Why do you say that?
Because nothing you can install will cause this crash.
Okay, yeah. Because I mean, I got a thing where it's, you know, because I know a couple times I saw this error with a page refault.
Yeah, page fault error. That's a bad. You got bad hardware.
Mm-hmm.
You need a new computer.
Okay.
So you can, if you wish, you could restore it. If you don't want to take the trouble of bringing it in, I would bring it in. And get a new one. It's a bad computer. It's bad. Bad computer. You're broken.
Okay.
It's broken. You don't get page faults because you installed Skype or anything else. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Our podcast today, as often is the case, brought to you by hover.com. Are you ready to register your domain name Or maybe you're just not getting the kind of service and support from your registrar you'd like. Well, I'd like to recommend Hover.com. So, you know, when I found out about Hover.com a few years back, I moved everything over. First of all, their concierge service, I wish I had used it. I didn't. I thought, oh, I can do this myself. They have concierge service. It'll transfer everything over. They'll do it for you. $25 flat rate for 100 or 200 or 1,000 domains. I think if you say, hey, Leo told me about this. I heard it on the tech guy. They might even waive that fee. And what do you get? Well, you're going to get a great registrar with great management tools, but also a service that's simple and honest and easy to use. For instance, when you register for a domain name at Hover, you don't have 80 clicks and all the upselling that the other sites do. It's very straightforward. Couldn't be simpler. You get Whois privacy automatically. They don't charge you extra for it. It's part of the deal because they know you're going to want that. Subdomains and URL forwarding. They don't host. It's just a registrar. And I think that's great because it means you choose the host you want and the registrar you need. Very easy to, for instance, create a memorable email address. You got a new kid, always a good idea to get their name for the email address, right? So it's for life. They offer all the main top-level domains, .com, .net, .org, .tv, Pro, Mobi, Biz, even country codes like .ca, .us, .asia, .uk. If you go there and you say, oh, man, I want something .com, and it's not available because most of the .coms, frankly, are long gone, they also will offer you the .net address of the same name, and that often is a very good choice. Everybody knows .net is the internet. Hover, HOVER.com. Save 10% on your first registrations when you use the offer code TECHGUY or visit hover.com/TECHGUY. See, I went there and it automatically activated the code TECHGUY. Hover.com/TECHGUY. And they do have that great no hold, no wait, no transfer phone support Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Their tech support folks are empowered, eager to help, and they don't have to say, well, let me ask the manager. They can do it. Great registrar. Highly recommend them. Hover.com/tech guy. Use them for your next domain name. Or better yet, transfer your domains over to hover.com. So what do Metallica.com, 4chan, and WikiLeaks have in common? They're all hosted by the same service called Cloudflare. 785,000 other websites as well. It's actually not really a hosting. It's a caching service. So what it does is they're on a host, but they go through Cloudflare so that if they get a lot of traffic, whether it's for real or an attack, they can respond to it. It speeds up the response time, and it prevents what's called distributed denial of service attacks. Cloudflare kind of screwed something up. We've heard this so many times before. Around 1:47 a.m. in California, a change got pushed out. I love the passive voice here. We don't know who did it. Mistakes were made. A change was pushed out that caused the edge routers in our network to crash. Now, that's a pretty big deal when that happens. If your router crashed, you'd be offline, wouldn't you? Well, the edge routers are the routers that Cloudflare uses to talk to the world. The CEO said, I don't want to, he told TechCrunch on the phone, I don't want to throw the router's vendor under the bus, but it caused them to crash. If you send a packet to one of our addresses, you'd get back a response, nothing here, nobody here. They all had to be manually rebooted. Oh, that means for a service like Cloudflare that's all over the world, every data center with a Cloudflare router had to be called. So it took a little while. And started 30 minutes after they went offline, they all started to come back up. But that if you went to Metallica, then 4chan, then WikiLeaks and wondered why all three were down, that's why, and many other sites. You know, I went to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office yesterday, and it was down. I thought that was odd. It's back up now. You wouldn't think a government website would go to it. Maybe they're on Cloudflare, too. These things happen, don't they? 8888 asked Leo, so that's I had to explain why we were playing Metallica. Actually, I don't need to explain it because they're a fine band, a fine, upstanding bunch of fellas. Walt in San Diego, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Walt.
Hey, Leo. How you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I am fine. Hope you're hearing me well. I'm trying to make sure I don't have any sort of echoes.
Are you on some form of voice over the internet protocol?
No, I'm plugged into a Palm Pre.
What? do you have that special module, a Palm Pre, huh?
Uh-huh,
is that your main phone? I shouldn't laugh. I really liked the Palm Pre when it came out. I shouldn't laugh. Is that your main phone?
No, my main phone is a Droid. But I didn't know how long I was going to last on this one. And this is the one my office has supplied to me. So
they're still offering them, hey?
I really shouldn't go there because I can't tell you who I'm employed by.
Well, let me see. Would it be HP? Well, no, that's all right. You don't have to say anything. Actually, HP recently sold parts of WebOS off, but I think they kept the Palm Pre portion of the business. LG, the TV company, LG is going to put it in their smart TVs. I actually like WebOS. I was a big fan, and I thought the Palm Pre, not great hardware, but a great demonstration of what the WebOS could do. Anyway,
I agree.
I digress.
And so do I. here's my situation. I bought a Foscam camera that I want to be able to access externally from my office.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, Foscam suggested I go get a URL, a free URL address from No IP, and point it to my IP address. Well, I'm on my ISP is Time Warner, so they have a public address that points to a group of routers, one of which my modem router is to come into my home. But then I go Ethernet straight to another Wi-Fi router.
So the deal is on this Foscam is it has inside it a little web server, a little browser. And if you could go directly to its internet address, you would see what's, the camera's seeing. Am I correct? Am I correct, sir?
That's correct.
So the issue is it's inside your personal network. It doesn't have a public address. It has a 192.168 address. And, of course, you can't see that from the outside world. So you have a few choices. You could use your router to DMZ the Foscam, and certain kinds of traffic would go to it. For instance, if you DMZ it, you could say, hey, whenever anybody comes here, or you could even do the port forwarding. I don't know what ports it uses, but I presume it's just a web browser, which means it's port 80. So you could say, if anybody knocks on my router, hello, looking for a web server, then go to the Foscam. So they would use your personal public address and go to it. Now, the only issue is if Time Warner from time to time, and it may, probably does, changes your personal public address, then you'd have to change the address you go to. So you can get around this. You mentioned no IP. Another one is DynDNS, DynDNS. And what happens with those is you have a little stub running on one of your computers. You can't run it on the Foscam, but on one of your computers, which periodically pings DynDNS and says, oh, yeah, my new address is, 24.1.3.17. And then DynDNS will automatically redirect. So it's a two-step thing. Run DynDNS. The truth is they may say, oh, you don't have a static IP address, but they probably never change it.
I don't think they're going to change, and if they did change, I'd be able to say, it changed. I'll have to look at what it is tonight and then fix it.
Exactly, because if it's just you visiting it, then you don't. Then it's not
right.
A big deal.
No.
You may have DynDNS built into your router, too. A lot of routers have that built in, so you don't even have to run any software on a computer to do that.
The problem is the public address. If I go to the public address, it almost looks like it's blocking everything. Because
it is.
Well, then how do I get to the point?
You tell the router. So what happens? Okay, so this is why routers make excellent security devices. If traffic is aimed at any computer, the computer will say, hey, I got incoming traffic, and try to do something with it. A lot of times computers have either flaws in their software, we call them exploits, that allow this kind of incoming traffic to be processed. You don't want it to be processed. Or, you know, they'll respond in some other inappropriate way. The big one was, for a long time, NetBIOS. If you had port 139 open for sharing file sharing on your local network and your computer was on the internet, a bad guy could just get into your network and say, hey, what else is here? So a router is great because you put a router, that's what's really your interface to the outside world, isn't it? And it, in effect, looks like your Time Warner address, 24.1.17.12 or whatever it is. That any traffic to that address hits the router. Now, the router is a dumb box of rocks, and it just bounces everything off unless it expects it. So when you surf the web, for instance, you establish a conversation, outbound conversation, through the router to a website. The router says, okay, I get it. He's talking to this website, so anything that comes from this website, I'm going to send to his computer. So now, but if it's unsolicited packets coming to that router, they bounce off because the router's stupid. It doesn't know what to do with it. So it's a firewall. In order to get your camera to work, you have to tell the router, hey, let this kind of traffic in. I'll talk about that a little bit when we come back. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. If you like the music, then our musical director, Kyle Benham, puts a playlist up after each show on his Google Plus page, Kyle Benham. Or you can find it on our website, techguylabs.com. Hello, Leo Laporte, the tech guy here. We were talking about a fairly geeky subject, but a good one to understand. And I think I can explain it. Walton San Diego has an IP camera, a spy cam, and many of them do this, that has built into it a web browser that lets you surf to the spy cam and see what the camera's looking at. This is great for security, right? You can open a browser on it, even on your smartphone, go to that address and see it. The problem is, it's on his network. So he's got a router that is the public face of his network. What he needs to do is tell the router what to do with inbound traffic. I have a page on Foscam's site, which we'll put in the show notes at Tech Guy Labs, that explains how to do what I was describing, which is called port forwarding. And what they suggest is, by default, the Foscam does look for port 80. That's the standard web port, but it's probably best not to use that. In fact, Time Warner may even be blocking port 80 because they don't want you to run a web server. That's dangerous. So they suggest making it port 8090, telling your router in the port forwarding section, hey, if anybody comes a knocking at port 8090, send them over to that Foscam over there. It'll know what to do. In order to set that up, of course, you need to know the internal address of your Foscam, what its local address is, this 192 address, and put that into your router settings. Now, there's a couple of caveats, things you should be aware of. We already mentioned the fact that Time Warner may change your public address from time to time. But as you say, if it stops working, you go home, or you get somebody at home to log into if you just go to Google and say, what is my IP address? It'll tell you your public address. And then that's the address you're going to be going to. And what you'll do is you'll go to that address. Let's say that address is 24.1.1.1. You'll go to 24.1.1.1:8090. What that says is, I'm not coming in on the normal 80 port, the normal web surfing port. I want to go in on port 80. And your browser will then contact your router, which is at 24.1.1.1, and say, hey, I've got some traffic for you on port 8090. What do you want me to do with it? And the router will say, well, actually, as a matter of fact, I've been instructed to send it over to the Foscam. And all should work. Does that make sense?
It does, but I think my problem is I have the public address that points to their modem router, or I believe a variety of modem routers.
No. No, the internet doesn't work that way. It's just like a phone number. It has to be unique.
Okay.
So you have a unique public address, which you can easily find by merely typing into your browser at home. You have to be at home. What is my IP address? And Google will...
I know my public. I even know the modem address of Time Warner's modem. I know my.
You don't care about that. That's your so-called gateway. You don't care about that.
Okay.
You don't care about anything but your personal, unique, one and only in the entire world, in the entire universe, IP address.
Right.
And if a browser goes to that IP address, especially if you do this whole setup I described, at port 8090, your router will say, I see you, and it will send you over to the Foscam. Now, it will do that with anybody. So you, if the Foscam has a password on it, I would turn that on.
It does.
Okay. And there have been in the past exploits. This was a big deal, and I can't remember the name of the camera, where it was easy to bypass the password. So just I wouldn't put the camera anytime you're putting a camera on the internet, just, you know, consider the risk.
It's watching my dogs. That's
it. Yeah. So if somebody comes and looks at your dogs, big deal, right?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, it's like, here, do you want them?
Take them.
The problem I was dealing with Time Warner was I couldn't get anything through the public address, and they say they're not blocking anything. So when I reference my URL at no IP, I put the public address.
Yeah.
And then what I like to do is I don't like to put the port on that. I like to add the port to the end of the address when I key it into my web.
Yeah, the only all no IP does, same as Dyn DNS, is it's dynamic DNS that accounts for the fact that Time Warner from time to time may change your public address. But as long as it doesn't, and most cable modem providers rarely change the IP address,
Right. Then
you don't even need the no IP or the Dyn DNS. You just use your public address. And you can find out what your public address is by literally Googling, what is my IP? And Google will tell you.
Yep, got all that information.
Yeah. So that's that. You don't need to know any other addresses. You don't need to know the so-called gateway address, which is Time Warner's, you know, and that what you connect with when you get online. You don't need to know anything else. Just your public IP address. Everybody's got one. It's like a belly button. But the most important point is you have one and only one. Time Warner may reassign that from time to time, but they don't. That's not very common. If you do have that issue and you want to do it automatically, then Dyn DNS or no IP will handle that. And the reason I spent some time with this, folks, is it's a good thing to understand what's going on. Maybe it's too much. I apologize. And Roto in our chat room apparently doesn't have a belly button. So, golly. Richard is in Rhode Island. Hi, Richard. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
How you doing, Leo?
I'm well. How are you?
My question is, I'm legally blind, and I'm looking for a cell phone. Of course, I'm looking for something audible. So.
Now, I, of course, am not an expert in this, but my blind listeners, and we have quite a few,
good,
tell me that they think the accessibility is best on the iPhone.
The iPhone,
yep.
Okay.
It has voiceover capability, so it will read you everything.
Yes.
I think, you know, while Android and Windows have worked very hard to make sure that they have good accessibility, there is none better at this point than the iPhone.
Okay. Now iPhone, you're talking, what, a couple $500? $500
well,
or so?
If it's usually subsidized by the carrier. To $200.
Okay.
Now, you can get, by the way, an older iPhone, a 4 or 4S. I think that I ask, who's your carrier?
Right now, I just have a plain track phone, which is buying the minutes card.
Yeah. You know? And there is track. There is a track phone. I think Virgin has a track phone iPhone. There are other you know, pay-as-you-go choices for iPhone. Generally, though, if you want to get the subsidized price, they want to get you in contract for a couple of years. The iPhone free is iPhone 4 is free with most carriers if you're on contract. The 4S is like $50, and the 5, the current version, is $200. But I think a 4S would be actually a very good choice, or a 4. Get a 4. You don't get Siri. The nice thing about the 4S is it has that, and I think for a blind user, Siri would be great because you can talk to the phone and it talks back to you. Apple has a long screed about its accessibility on the iPhone. Nerve just posted it in the chat room. We'll put it in our show notes at techguylab.com, which they talk about the capabilities of the iPhone, including VoiceOver, which is kind of like Jaws. You know, it reads you your screen. They have a lot of nice features, including the ability to use Braille displays. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. It's time to talk computers and the internet and cell phones and camcorders and MP3 players and all that jazz. Half past the hour, 33 and a third, exactly past the hour. Chris Marquardt, our photo guy, joins us. We have an open studio here at the Brick House, the Tech Guy Labs, and it's really nice. We always have wonderful people stopping by to visit. And I have to say, I'm just blown away. Mr. Dandy is here from MrDandy.com, James Hakola. Is that how you pronounce it? Hakola. And he has made a, I want to say life-size. It's not. It's only about 8 inches, but it feels like it's life-size. Bobblehead of me, Chief Twit, that speaks and says pithy comments. Wow, that is cool. I love that when I hit its head. Everybody should have one of these, and they could just hit the head, and it would say, reboot. The printer is broken. Have you tried turning it off and on again? Wow, that is so cool. Thank you, James. Wow, MrDandy.com. You should put this up on Mr. Dandy. You have my permission if you want to sell me. Voodoo pins not included, okay? 8888-ASK-LEO, that's the phone number. Evan in Long Island, New York. We had Rhode Island, now we have Long Island. Hello, Evan.
Hi. Wanted to ask you a question about the MacBook Pro with Retina.
Mm.
All right. I was
love it. Yeah.
I haven't pulled the trigger yet, but I was going to get the base model because I don't think any more processing power is really needed.
I agree. I got the base model myself.
Yeah, and the only one thing that puzzled me was whether I should get the 16-gigabyte DDR3 upgrade for $200 more, or if it is just enough.
I got the 8. It comes with 8, right?
Mm-hmm.
I got the 8. 8 gigs is a lot. I don't think there's very little you could do on a computer that you would see a difference in performance going from 8 to 16. 4 to 8 is not a bad move. The improvement is smaller and smaller as you go up. Now, I'm going to tell you the negative on the Retina, and it doesn't bother me, but I've heard people talk about it, which is it's pushing so many pixels. This is such a high-resolution display that there's occasional lag, particularly if you're swiping a desktop from one to the other, things like that. I don't notice it, but it's using the built-in Intel graphics on the base model. Now, they have upgraded the graphics on the newer, higher-end model, but they're considerably more expensive. If you're the kind of person that might be bothered by a laggy Retina display, you probably will want to spend, and by the way, you're going to spend like $800 more, the newer ones that have the NVIDIA GeForce GT 650M. That's the video card. Because the one I have and the base model just have built-in HD graphics from Intel. Now, I haven't noticed a problem, okay? Doesn't bother me. And I'm not sure whether it'll bother you or not. You probably should go to an Apple store and do some graphic-intensive stuff. The biggest one, of course, is swiping the desktop. So you know that Apple supports these Spaces desktops where you can have a full-screen browser on one and a full-screen Photoshop on another and whatever. Load it up with 8 full-screen apps and then swipe one or the other and see if it bothers you. It doesn't bother me. But I've talked to a lot of people. They say, oh, yeah, it's sluggish. I don't notice it. I love the MacBook Pro Retina.
All right. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Highly
also,
recommend it.
I wanted to mention, I was watching the Attack of the Show, and I saw your little piece at the end. It was great with the jetpack.
So much fun to do. So Attack of the Show, which is now off the air, as is the channel it was on G4, they were the successor to the TV show I did from 98 to 2004 called The Screensavers. Patrick Norton and I hosted that show. And the G4 folks bought Tech TV, the channel Patrick and I worked for, fired us, but kept doing the show with other people and eventually renamed it. But I was really touched when the producers came to me and Patrick and said, hey, you know, the Attack of the Show is over. After 8 years or whatever, it's over. And, yeah, they had it for 8 years. We did it for 6. They had it for 8. So they did it longer than we did. But we would like to, at the very last bit of it, we'd like to acknowledge our roots, the screensavers, and have you and Patrick do a little bit. And I said, yeah, love to. And to their credit, they kind of dissed themselves in a way by having me wake up and say, boy, I just had this terrible dream. We were doing the screensaver. And the show had been sold, and they wanted and moved us to L.A., and they started us doing this horrible kind of nerd, geek, nonsense, culture stuff. And, oh, it was terrible. And Patrick said, well, forget about it. We got to get to work. And we, as you said, donned jetpacks and flew into to the San Francisco skyline, which is where Tech TV was, and the Tech TV building. And there were flying cars. So the best part of this whole thing, Evan, was if they hadn't canceled the screensavers, we would have flying cars by now.
It would have all been because of you.
Evan, I appreciate it. Yeah, you're going to love the Retina. I think Apple's on to something with these high-res displays. It started with their iPhone, and then they did it on the iPad, and now they're doing it on a laptop, on a MacBook. There's just something so gorgeous about it. Now, the other negative is that it makes some of the web look terrible because a lot of the web has not yet been upgraded to high resolution. So you see how low. It's like when you get an HDTV. It's very much like when you get an HDTV and you continue to watch regular television. And for many years, you know, stuff looked bad because all of a sudden you were seeing it in high def. And standard definition doesn't look so good in high def. Same problem on the MacBook Pro with Retina. Some things just don't look, they look a little fuzzy. Some applications don't take advantage of it, but more and more are. And I do believe the future is these high-res screens, but they push so many pixels. These are 4 or 5 megapixel screens now. They push so many pixels that they really need a lot of processing power, and particularly graphics processing power. So if graphics performance is important to you, you might spend a little bit more. Boy, it's nice that they offer this as a choice. It's really expensive. It's really expensive. And you don't get more memory. There's still 8 gigs of RAM. Actually, no, they have one with 16 gigs of RAM and a 512. You know, if you really want to go crazy, 512 gigabyte flash storage, 16 gigs of RAM, and this new video card, the NVIDIA GeForce card. $2,800. Oh, man. That's more than $1,400. $1,300 more than I paid for mine. And I love mine. Get the base model, unless you're really picky. Kevin in Philly. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, Leo. Long time fan. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. So I just built a computer, and I went all out and have a Blu-ray drive. But now I don't have any software to play the Blu-ray.
Yeah. It's unfortunate, but I presume it's a Windows machine. It used to be when you got Windows, you'd get a DVD player. But they don't want to pay a lot of times they don't want to pay the money for the DVD software. I use the software from CyberLink. It's called Power DVD. But there's also what's the other one? WinDVD. Let me ask the chat room, because I don't know. Can you play Blu-rays with VLC? If you can, that would be the free choice. Video LAN client. Have you tried it?
I've tried it, and online people say, like, download this file and that file.
You need the codecs, right? You need this. And Blu-ray has severe copy protection on it, so you probably need to get around that as well. I think that's the reason you don't see Blu-ray software, because the license for this stuff is expensive. Power Director, or Power DVD, I should say. That's the one to get. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. So Colonel Clink's telling me in the chat room that Lifehacker said the best video player for Windows is something called POT Player, P-O-T, POT Player, and that will play back Blu-ray. The trick with, there are ways to play back Blu-ray that are illegal. And I think if you're downloading free codecs and using VLC, a free program to play it, you're breaking the law. So spend $50 and buy Power DVD. You'll be happier. You really will. I'm sure there are hacks, but let's just do it right. Lance in Springfield, Massachusetts. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Lance.
These coast is on fire for you today, huh?
It's on fire! En fuego! We have, you know, we have so many stations now. It's great. It's just really great.
That is good.
Yeah.
Just a personal aside, how did your daughter like New York, going to school in New York?
She loved it. She went to Bard, which is in upstate New York on the Hudson River, mid-state New York. The only thing was she's a California girl, and the winter liked to kill her. She said, "What is this white stuff that keeps coming from the sky and piling up? They really should clean it up."
Yeah. I'll tell you the truth. I'm glad you said Bard, because which she first went there. I guess that because I had actually done the drywall in the museum in another science building there.
That museum is gorgeous. They have a modern art museum. It's so new. It doesn't have a road, but it's gorgeous. You did a nice job.
Thank you. my question is this. I'm having difficulty when I go to connect to a network. It's very slow. It takes like 20 minutes to load up. And then when I went to manage my wireless screen or whatever that line is, I find out I have nearly 4,000 available slots to go to.
Okay, I'm really confused. You're saying when you turn on Wi-Fi, it takes 20 minutes to work?
Yeah, it takes.
And you say that there are 4,000 Wi-Fi access points that are visible?
Right.
That can't be. That's not. Really? Do you live in a I can't imagine where there'd be that many. It must be a
Here's the problem. I'm a truck driver, and I think what it's doing is pinging everything that's along the road.
Oh yeah, as you're driving down, and it's remembering it, right?
Right. So what I want to do is get rid of them, but I don't. I mean, they show a little tab where you could get rid of.
I know,
one.
But one by one, that's annoying.
Right, so I didn't know if you had a trick up your sleeve that I might be able to get rid of all 4,000 at once.
So what's happening is and a lot of devices will do this. It remembers Wi-Fi networks. A couple of things. First of all, you don't want it to remember networks you don't join. So I would look at the settings and make sure it's not just joining any open network it sees. That's not safe.
Okay.
So and then it shouldn't. I don't know what software it came. What's the name of the software? It's not the Windows software, obviously. It's some other software.
Oh no, it's Windows Vista.
Yeah, but when you get a computer with Wi-Fi capability, usually you have at least two Wi-Fi programs: the built-in Windows program, and then Intel or whatever company made the Wi-Fi chipset will also have some software. I would uninstall the other Wi-Fi software, whatever it is, Intel or whoever made the Wi-Fi card, and use the Windows software. It's generally better. Tell it not to join things that just because it sees them, and it shouldn't. And if you do change this Windows player, it won't have any memory, so you shouldn't see all these access points. It should not be recording access points as it drives along. That's very strange.
Well, I mean, I look at them, I'm just like, what are
that's terrible. We don't want that. And that may be why it takes so long to get on a Wi-Fi network. It's got a lot of junk in there. Because I don't know what program you're using. I don't know if there's a reset. You can go one by one and forget network, but if you have that many, it's not going to be worth it. Normally, this is an unusual behavior. This is what we call war driving, where you drive down the street and record all the Wi-Fi access spots you see.
Huh.
So I wonder what the software is that's doing this. Make sure you uncheck join open Wi-Fi. If that's an option, uncheck that. Turn that off. You don't want to do that.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not very... savvy, but
somebody said, are you driving Google Street View? Because this is what Google did, right? And got in a lot of trouble for. That's very odd. It should not record that. It shouldn't be recording that. It shouldn't be recording that.
It should.
No.
Okay.
No. And you should turn that off. And I would suggest using the Windows Wi-Fi tool as opposed to whatever one came with your computer.
Okay, so just go through the settings or something?
Yeah, look in your programs and features control panel and uninstall. I don't want to break it, so maybe uninstalling is the wrong thing. Make sure that the Intel one doesn't start up. I bet you it's Intel. And have the Windows one start up. Or okay. Maybe from the computer's manufacturer. You know, who made the computer?
Acer.
Yeah, so it may be that Acer has a Wi-Fi tool that's installing. Let me just see, because I'm sitting in front of an Acer. If there's an Acer Wi-Fi tool in here. Acer USB charge manual, backup, power management, theft shield recovery management, but no Wi-Fi tool, oddly enough. Maybe they decided that it wasn't a good idea. I wonder if this Acer is doing the same thing. Let me bring up the Wi-Fi software. That's the one that has, you know, the little bars in it open. And, yeah, it should be the Network and Sharing Center, which is the Windows one. Apparently, Acer stopped doing that because this Acer, and I haven't removed anything, is using the Windows tool as opposed to any third-party tool. That is a strange thing. You don't want to be recording all of these. I don't see a bunch of that. I see the access points I can see and no others right now. And that's what you want. Now I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 because I can see, you know, and where I'm sitting, I see 10 access spots. But it's just the ones that are visible to my area. No memorized access spots. I bet you have a Vista computer. You have probably some software that Acer put on there. Find the Acer Wi-Fi tool and disable it. Maybe not install it. I don't want to break your Wi-Fi. Ruth in Anaheim, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Ruth.
Yes, Leo. I'd like your opinion about smartwatches.
Oh, I think they stink. Let's talk about it. We're going to take a break, but that's the short answer. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. The Tech Guy Show today brought to you by My Phone System. We use Ring Central here in the Tech Guy Labs, and I am a huge fan. When we moved over here, we needed to set up a phone system. Didn't want a PBX. I had experience with a PBX before, and it was just the worst. The thing is, this is modern. The thing about Ring Central is it's cloud-based. There's no startup cost. There's no hardware. You as little as $20 a month per user. You just plug in the phone, and you get all sorts of great features. Customize all your call handling. We've got a great voice tree. Chad loves the idea that he can use his cell phone and the free RingCentral software to make phone calls on his cell phone, but we pay the cost. It appears to be coming from the business number. He can even send and receive business text messages from your business phone number. And when incoming messages go to our 800 number, they come in as text messages to his phone or whoever's phone they're aimed at. It's pretty cool. Voicemail in your email, faxes too. And right now, you could try it with a 30-day risk-free trial, plus a special offer for you, my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, RingCentral will give you the second phone free up to a total of 20 phones. RingCentral.com. We've got a number just for you, 800-543-9980. RingCentral.com. It's a completely cloud-based phone system that we're just so happy with it. And I could tell you because we've been using it now for a year and a half with nary a glitch. RingCentral.com. Use the promo code TWIT or call 800-543-9980 to sign up for a 30-day no-risk trial. RingCentral.com. Chris Marquardt is here, our photo guy. Before I put you on, Chris, I want to finish up with Ruth. I gave her short shrift, even though I gave her the right answer. Hi, Ruth.
Hi.
You were asking me about smartwatches. Do you mean like the Pebble watch?
I don't really know a thing about them. I just heard about them a few days ago.
Yeah, they just
sounded like a good idea for me.
Yeah, they're hot right now.
All I really want it for is the cell phone part of it.
Yeah, but it's not a cell phone.
It isn't.
It's not like a Dick Tracy where you talk to it. It attaches to a cell phone. You still need a cell phone. And the watch, when the phone rings, will beep. Or if you get a text message, it'll show up on the watch's face. It's a dumb idea.
So it is not, you can't use it as a cell phone.
No, it's not a cell phone yet.
Okay. Will they make those, you think?
Yeah, maybe. They're trying this out. You know, Apple is rumored to be doing an iWatch. The current choices are the IM Watch, which is an Italian company. I tried it. Horrible. And it does require a cell phone. And then there's this Pebble Watch, which is the most successful Kickstarter project of all time. I don't have one yet. Mine is delayed, but I did order one. But my experience is, it's not going to do what you think it does. All it does is it tells you if the phone's ringing, but you know that because it's in your pocket. And it shows you text messages. Okay. It's not so hard to take it out of the pocket after it buzzes and say, oh, there's a text message. I don't understand the point.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Sure, Ruth. I appreciate the call. I'm glad I could save you some money because these things are expensive. You charge them every day. It just doesn't make sense. I don't get it. Chris Marquardt is here, our photo guy. He is a digital photography expert. Didn't you work, before you were a photographer, I know you worked for HP. Did you work in IT? What did you do, Chris?
Mostly projects, mostly online projects. So I wasn't really in hardware or any of that kind of stuff. So
you were a programmer?
No, project manager.
You managed programmers.
So, yep, I did that. And some online projects, some portal stuff. So web stuff, pretty much.
Now you know why he's a photographer, folks. He decided he wanted to have fun.
I always wanted to be something creative. But it just didn't make enough money. So the day job took over. And then after a while, I found out that the creative side is really the area. But that gives me a good understanding of also the technical side. So both sides are kind of equally important in photography, I think.
It makes you a good person to explain digital photography, because while there's a lot of art, of course, in all photography, to become a digital photographer, you kind of need to understand how the camera works.
True.
Nowadays, they're
true.
So complicated. There's so much to them.
And there are so many myths in photography, so many things that people take at face value because someone told them. And so I've set out to bust a few photography myths, and one of them is that you must have special gear to shoot lightning.
Oh.
But that's just not true, because almost every camera can shoot lightning, even an iPhone.
But it's kind of hard. You have to have good timing.
No, it's not. That's the thing. It is not that hard. You put the camera on a steady surface. The secret is you do not snap at the moment when the lightning happens, but you take long exposures, 10 seconds, 20 seconds, and during those long exposures, the lightning hits. And then it gets burned onto the sensor, onto the picture. So you put the camera on a steady thing, on a tripod or on a crumpled up jacket
and
or something.
And you just open the shutter.
You open the shutter.
In some cameras, that would be the bulb mode or the B mode.
That's what we call the bulb mode. Yeah. Or set it to, actually, I set it to a timed mode, 10 or 20 seconds. You zoom out. You want a bit of a wide angle to cover more area because you never know where it's really going to strike. Focus on something that's far away. Focus is important. So this is where I set your camera to manual focus. But you focus on something that is far away, 100 feet, 200 feet, a street light or something, or maybe the moon. That'll do, typically. And then you leave it there on that focus setting, and that will get you the lightning in focus. Yeah, and then
you'd probably want to use a fairly narrow aperture too, right, to help the focus.
Yeah, but if you're a bit wide angle, that is not a big issue. Okay. So aperture 5.6, shutter speed of, let's say, 10 seconds, ISO 400. Those are pretty good start settings. And then what you do is you take a test exposure. You wait for those 10 seconds, and then you look how it's coming out without the lightning. Do we have a bit of, like, the surroundings in there, a bit of the, let's say, a cityscape or something to place that lightning in? And if that works out, if it's too dark, get a bit of a long exposure, 15 seconds, 20 maybe, a bit of a higher ISO until you got that right. And then the secret is simply take as many pictures as you can. Keep shooting. 10-second exposures, another one, another one, another one. I once did that for 2 hours in a row.
Wow.
It was incredibly exciting. Actually, if you go to tfttf.com/028, that's a very old episode of my podcast. And I recorded this thing. It's kind of cut down to about half an hour where I did 2 hours of lightning photography. And
so you could listen to Chris take pictures.
You can listen how to do that. And the sound quality is awful. This is like 8 years ago. But it's really exciting to listen to, because the thunderstorm comes up and I take these photos. And then every now and then I hit one, or I almost hit one, but I don't get it. But just be patient and take lots of pictures. And then you can do this with an iPhone. There's an app out there.
I don't understand. Oh, there's an app. Okay, because the iPhone doesn't have a bulb mode.
No, it doesn't. But there's an app called Slow Shutter. And if you set that on manual mode and you have a little preview, it does the same thing your OMD, your new camera does. It has a mode in it where it kind of builds up the shot. So it adds light slowly to it. And you see on the display how it adds that light. And the picture gets brighter and brighter over time. And then if a lightning strike comes in, you just stop the exposure and you caught some lightning. It's really not that hard.
What's the name of that app again? That's neat.
Slow Shutter.
Slow Shutter. And we were talking about the new camera I got, the Olympus OMD, which I'm kind of a little bit have a crush on. And you said it has some sort of mode that lets me do time exposures and see how it's going.
You can watch it build up. So as soon as it's bright enough, after a few seconds, you just let go of the shutter, and that concludes the exposure. And
That's awesome. You
can pretty much watch it happen over seconds.
Could I make lightning shots with that?
Yes, absolutely. It does work with that. Yes.
Okay. Maybe our next assignment should be lightning.
Ooh, tough one.
Yeah. First of all, we don't have lightning out here. I'd have to travel. We're very rare to have a thunderstorm out here. So, but our assignment right now is it resolution?
Ice.
That's right.
Ice. Our current assignment is ice. Still kind of wintry. Yes.
Yeah. So, but it could be anything. And this time I've got to take a picture with my new camera. So I'm going to take an ice picture. What is ice to you? Well, we're not going to tell you. You just have to illustrate the concept or word ice. Upload that picture to Flickr, the tech guy group on Flickr. And you can do one new picture every week. We do like you to take new pictures. The whole point of this really is to get you out there with your camera taking pictures.
You have to learn, yes.
Yeah.
The only way to learn is to do it.
We have a guy in the chat room, Y Guy, who's a storm chaser.
Ooh, he says, probably has a lot of awesome lightning pictures.
No, he says his pictures rarely turn out. That's because he's always running away and shooting over his back.
Yeah, I mean, if you shoot lightning, be safe, okay?
Yeah, don't get on a tall building. Yeah, good point. Thank you, Chris. ChrisMarquardt.com. If you want to know more, visit our website, techguylabs.com. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
My end-user licensing agreement does not cover you. To all virtual assistants.
This is why Siri and Valentine's Day do not go together. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888, ask Leo. You know, this is a hot category. We were talking before Chris Marquardt about smartwatches, and Ruth wanted to know if she should get one, and basically I say no. It's too early. And this is a category that is definitely not hitting its stride by any means. And what she wanted, which I think is not an unusual desire, is one that could be a phone. But no, the way these work right now, they tie into a phone. They're not a phone by themselves. It's not impossible that they could be a phone. In fact, I think it's Big Jim in our chat room who said that somebody did make a watch phone, but it just didn't take off. Probably was too thick, battery life too low. But you're going to see a lot of these. The strong rumor, and I think credible rumor, that Apple's working on one is just one of many that we're going to see, because this is a category of computing that users haven't decided they want, but the companies have decided they will want. Wearable computers. Google's got this Glass project. You know, glasses, even if you don't need glasses you wear so that you can get more information about the world around you. Bad idea. Really bad idea. They have a built-in camera so you can take pictures of people without their knowledge. Really bad idea. Apple's got the... This is a category that you're going to have to prove to me people really want. I don't think people... Oh, you don't have to crawl. You can just walk right in front of the camera. No wonder. I have people crawling through the studio. I think this is a category that people just really have not been asking for. But the companies, remember, the stock market, the tech industry is so fevered, so overheated that if you're not doubling your revenue every year, you're considered a flop, a failure. So there's this intense pressure on all of these companies to come up with the next big thing. And I think we've gone past the time when we can ask users what the next big thing is. Maybe we never could. I don't know. It seemed like there were certain things like home computer. A lot of people thought nobody wants a computer. But remember when Woz designed the Apple, he went to HP first and said, would you like this? And they said, no. IBM did a famous study in the 60s in which they said the entire, or maybe it was earlier than that, maybe the 40s, the entire world market for computers is seven. But they were very tied into what a computer was. And so it's not unusual for the industry to not know what's next and for people not to know what's next. And so it's completely possible that wearable computing will be an amazing revolution, but not yet. No reason to run out and get one today, as far as I can tell. If you think I'm wrong, call me, 8888. Ask Leo. That's the phone number. Sam is in Costa Mesa, our next caller. Hi, Sam. Leo Laporte here. Oh, you know, I keep losing focus. Hey, Sam, go ahead.
Okay. I've got Windows. Two quick questions for you.
Yeah.
I have Windows Pro 7 on my PC.
Okay.
And I want to add ESET. I had it before. My question is, do I disable all the Microsoft security on it so they don't clash?
Oh, that's a very good question. You have Windows 7, so you have did you install Security Essentials, or you just have Defender on there?
It's whatever came on.
You didn't install anything edition. No, you're fine.
Yeah.
So the Windows Firewall, if you have Windows Defender on there, that's fine. What you don't want to install is Microsoft's antivirus, which is called Security Essentials. You shouldn't have two antiviruses running at the same time.
Okay. Yeah. I'm sure I don't have the Microsoft.
But if you're running the stock Windows 7, you haven't installed any security software in addition to what came with it, ESET is a very good choice.
Okay. Second question, occasionally when I'm watching, let's say I'm on Fox News and I'm trying to watch one of the pre-recorded videos, I'm doing this on Google, and all of a sudden it will not play them. It will show me a TV screen. It will be black, and if you click pause, the pause button works, the play button works, no video comes.
When you say you're on Google, you mean you're on YouTube?
No, just Google search engine.
So you search for it, but doesn't it?
Google Chrome. And I, you know, let's say I go.
But
to
it sends
Fox,
you to the Fox site, right? You're not on the Google site. You're on the Fox site, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
And you're on a desktop, not a tablet.
Correct. Now, if I go to like Bing or some other search engine, like Ask, then I can go to Fox News and it will play the video.
That's interesting.
It seems like it's a Google thing.
Google because Chrome. You searched for it. Oh, okay. So Google Chrome has its own version of Flash built in. So when you say you're on Google, you mean you're on Chrome.
Yeah, I'm on Chrome.
Yeah. Google has its own version of Flash. If you're using Internet Explorer or some other browser, then you're using the Flash plugin that's installed on your computer. It sounds like a Flash issue, and in fact, some of the people in the chat room are saying that the same thing happens to them on Chrome. Insane Techie says it happens to him on Chrome. I haven't experienced that, but I would guess it's that the version of Chrome that Google's using is not working right. This is one of the reasons why we don't like Flash too much. Flash is very finicky and picky, and I think the world is moving away from it. I would probably download Flash, the latest Flash. You want it anyway because Flash has some severe bugs in it, so you don't want to use old versions of Flash. Go to Adobe.com and download the Flash Player, latest Flash 11 Player, and install it. Not in the browser, but install the standalone downloader just like you would any other program and see if that fixes it. I would suspect that it's just something wrong in the Flash that comes with Chrome. Also, make sure you got the latest version of Chrome, by the way. Now, normally, you don't have to do that, but if for some reason you turned off updates, that could be it. Greg in Mission Viejo, California, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Leo. It's great to talk to you. I've been listening to you for a long time.
Thank you.
I hate to admit how many Apple products I have in my house.
It's okay. He's a self-hating Apple lover.
It at home. I use it every place.
It's okay.
But boy, I've got big screen phone envy.
Yeah, you know, I'm a little mad at Apple. They went from 3.5 inches to 4, but they did it in such a weird way.
Yeah. So I keep looking at the Galaxy as
the Note.
The people on the plane that.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about the Galaxy 4S.
Yeah, the S4 is not out. It will be announced on March 15th. Mm. Probably won't be out till April. Can you wait that long?
Probably.
I think it's going to be a nice phone. I would. It's probably. I think it's under 5 inches. I think 4.8 or 4.9, but I'm not sure. Because you know, it's all rumor.
My biggest concern is moving from my Apple world to the world of Android, particularly.
Well, Greg, hang on, because we got to take a break for news. But I think that's a good question. Let's spend some time on it when we come back. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy, hour number three of the Tech Guy Show. 8888 Ask Leo, that's the phone number if you want to ask a question, make a comment, make a suggestion. 888-827-5536, toll free in the U.S. You can also visit our website. Well, lots of good stuff there for you, always free, always open. TechGuyLabs.com. TechGuyLabs.com. We were talking to Greg in Mission Viejo, making the switch. He's got an iPhone 5, but he wants a bigger screen. So he's going Android. And the real advantage of Android is choice. You know, the advantage of iPhone is it's a very controlled ecosystem. And so, you know, it's going to be consistent. There's a great app ecosystem, although I would argue Android's is equally diverse. But the nice thing about Android is you can all different phones, lots of manufacturers to choose from. I have a Galaxy Note 2, which is the biggest Android phone out there, 5.5 inches, and I'm happy with it. Although one of them died. I have two of them. This is the one from Sprint that I'm holding. Can you see that on the radio? But the other one was a unlocked European model that I bought, and I doubt I can get it fixed, but we'll see. I'll try to get it fixed. It just bricked on me recently. So I'm looking for a new Android phone, too. This is a very good time, Greg, to be looking. As you mentioned, Samsung's got the Galaxy S4 coming, which will probably be a killer phone, just as the S3 was. I like the HTC One. This is going to be an AT&T, T-Mobile, and Sprint, and I think will be a very nice phone. Kind of an iPhone-y phone, unibody, aluminum construction, and all that. But you said you wanted, there were some questions about making the transition. So let me help you with that. What particularly are you worried about?
So I'm not worried about calendar because I can figure that one out. I use Google Calendar mostly anyway.
If you use Google anything, your Android will be great.
Pictures, notes, music, and particularly podcasts. I travel. And I take you with me on the plane every week in six or seven different places. So.
Every week you travel. Wow. Are you a pilot?
Just one of those people that fly for a living.
Wow. Yeah, okay, so there's very good choices out there in every category that you just mentioned. Let's start with podcasts. There used to be, just as Apple has a podcast app, there used to be a Google app called Listen. Apple's podcast app is terrible. Google Listen wasn't so good. The good news is there are third-party apps that are better, in my opinion. Quite a few of them for both Apple and for Android. Let me see which one I'm using on here. I think it's, I want to say Dog Catcher. Yeah, that's the one I'm using. And I like that, D-O-double-G. It's better than anything I've seen on the iPhone. Well, Instacast is pretty good on the iPhone. But Dog Catcher is very good. I'd start there. I think it's a couple of bucks.
Yeah, I can afford a couple of bucks if I buy a new phone.
Yeah, you're spending a new. Somebody else says they like Pocket Casts, Beyond Pod. Another very popular one is Downcast. I don't know if that's, is Downcast Android? No, I thought so. Downcast is currently only on iOS. But that's a good iOS choice. I would say, but, you know, I've been using Dog Catcher, very, very happy. Now, let's see, what else did you want to know? Music?
Music, yeah.
Yeah, that's the trickiest one if you're an iTunes user.
Yeah, exactly.
So, first thing to do is make sure that none of your iTunes music is copy protected. You know, Apple no longer sells copy protected music, but if you bought stuff on iTunes a few years back, it was. You can use iTunes Match for $25. And convert all your copy-protected music to unprotected music. That's the first step.
Okay.
Once it's unprotected, then you have some great choices. I actually use Google Music for up to, I think, 25,000 tracks. It's free. You upload it, just as you do with iTunes Match, you upload it to the Google servers if they don't already have it, and then you have a Google Music app on your phone that will stream it or download it. Okay. If you want to sync up as you used to with iTunes, and there's a great program that's free called Double Twist. Runs on your Mac or PC, and then you can just synchronize to your phone over USB, or you can run Double Twist's Air Twist solution to sync over Wi-Fi. Those are excellent. I use Evernote, and I just think everybody should use Evernote on every platform, because if you had been using it all along on the iPhone, then you wouldn't have to worry. You just put it on the Android phone, and all your notes would be there.
Right, I have, so that's good.
Then you're set.
And then pictures, I don't take that many with me, but I can always move those over.
Google does the same thing that Apple does. You know, Apple has the photo stream. Google Plus, which is their social network, the Google Plus app will also copy all your pictures up to Google. So you have backup copies of that and can download them on the desktop. You could also use Dropbox to do that. Dropbox will do that automatically.
Great. Leo, you're terrific. We've listened to you for years. You really helped me through a lot of stuff. I appreciate your being on the phone.
Thank you, Greg. It's always good to talk to somebody who's interested in this stuff, wants to know more. I'm really glad to help. There are so many great choices now on both platforms. I don't think there's a compelling reason to go with one or the other. But exactly the transition that you're talking about is exactly the rub. Same thing moving from Mac to Windows or Windows to Mac. It's not that one is better than the other. It isn't. They're different. And so you have to adjust and understand. It's not so hard. It's not so hard. Pretty easy to do. We should mention Evernote was hacked. People in the chat room are going, oh, Evernote was hacked. Evernote did a very interesting thing. February 28th, just a few days ago, they noted that somebody had broken into their systems. They immediately implemented the security measures needed to protect your data and did something I think very, very admirable. They announced it on their Evernote blog and sent a note to all Evernote users, an email, saying, we've reset your password. You must go to your Evernote account and change the password. It won't work anymore. I think that's the kind of aggressive and very honest and forthright handling of a hack that is I think going to become the norm. We're seeing that more and more. Used to be people just didn't admit it. They didn't talk about it. It was a secret. They were embarrassed. Now it happens. It happens more often than one would want, but it happens. They are saying, and I believe them, that no personal, data was revealed, that all the hackers got was names, email addresses, and passwords. And furthermore, Evernote had been doing the right thing with the passwords, encrypting and salting them, hashed and salted. Which sounds like snack, but it's actually the approved way of storing passwords so that getting the password file doesn't reveal anything. Nevertheless, even though they secured your password as well as can possibly be done with hashing and salting, they still reset all the passwords. So they bent over backwards. Admittedly, a little bit of an inconvenience. You have to go to the Evernote account on the web and give it a new password, but I think the right way to handle it, particularly since many of us use Evernote to store lots of stuff, including my passports are up there, my social security number is stored in Evernote, my driver's license, all my credit card numbers, all that stuff is stored in Evernote. If somebody were to get my Evernote file, I'd be in deep trouble. Now, Evernote does offer encryption, and I encrypt all of the data within Evernote that is private, but it would be a cause for concern. Dr. Mack asks, if I've been managing my Evernote password, with LastPass effectively, do I still need to change it? Yeah, they reset everybody's password. I have a strong password in Evernote, a very strong password that I only use on Evernote. And because they salt and hash it, I am not at risk. However, I don't have the choice. They reset my password. And I think that's still the way to do it. So you don't have a choice, Dr. Mack. Even though you may have a secure password and you've been secure with it, you have to create a new password. All the old passwords are gone. Gone. Carlos says, notice how Twitter never makes you do it. Actually, they just did with about 250,000 of us, myself included, because they were recently hacked and they reset to the people whose passwords were hacked. They forced us to reset too. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Yo ho ho is what you say. What's the pirate password now?
Yo ho ho! Yo ho ho!
Army matey, it's a pirate. He's stolen all your passwords. So I guess I should explain. I started to explain it, and I thought, this is not probably family fair, but I am. I'm going to take a chance. I'm going to take a wild chance and explain what salting and hashing is. So as I mentioned, Evernote was recently hacked. Twitter has had this happen. It's not unusual. I think LinkedIn, a number, you know, hackers are always going at these companies, always trying to break in. And if they're successful, what they may get is the very important file from the point of view of this company that includes all the users' names and their passwords. Now, the worst way a company like Evernote could store usernames and passwords would be as plain text. Leo Laporte, his password is monkey123. If a bad guy gets that, he's got everybody's password. He could just log on to their account. No problem. Easy. Oy, that's bad. So most companies, you'd be surprised how many companies still do that, by the way. And banks and companies that really ought to know better. But most companies now at least encrypt the password usually what they do is they encrypt it using something called a hash. And there's a reason why you would encrypt it using a hash, because it needs to be reversible. So you run the password through a thing, usually meshing it with another word, that produces a scrambled up result. You still need to be able, when I log into the account, you still need to be able to say, well, is this his password? And there's a way to do that. You take what I typed in, you run it through the same hashing algorithm, and you should get the same result, right? And then look it up and say, well, is this gobbledygook the same as the gobbledygook we store? The advantage of doing this is a bad guy can't look at the result and figure out what your password is. The result is, you know, the file he downloaded just has gobbledygook in it. But it's not enough just to do that, because bad guys are smart, and they've made something called rainbow tables. It turns out that you can reverse it with enough computing power and enough information. It's possible to reverse this hashing technique. So hashing is not enough. It's a good start, but it's not going to foil smart hackers. You need to then salt the hash, which sounds delicious, but all it really means is we're kind of further obfuscating it in such a way that it's not easily deduced. It can, with sufficient computing power, still be reversed in some cases, but there's not enough power to do it in a reasonable way with millions of passwords. So the good news is Evernote did what is considered the state of the art with your password. They hashed it and salted it. And as a result, it's very unlikely that a bad guy could get to, you know, this hashed, salted password and figure out what your password is. But they bent over backwards. They took the extra step of still making you reset your password. You know, it's probably the moral of this, though, is important, which is the real risk is that if you use the same password for multiple sites, and a bad guy can get your password for one site, he might be able to use that password and will try, certainly, to use that password on other sites. So let's say you use the same password on Evernote as you used on Twitter, and they got your Twitter password. They would try your Evernote account. And if they got in, oh, you're in trouble, right? So the moral of this is, even with salted and hashed passwords, it's a good idea not to use the same password more than once. My recommendation is to use a program called LastPass. There's other ones called 1Password, and there's an open source password program called, I can't remember off the top of my head. Somebody in the chat room will tell me. KeePass, that's it. KeePass, LastPass, or 1Download, those are the three most common. These are password storage tools. They keep track of your passwords, but they will also generate strong passwords. And because they're storing them, you won't be so inclined to use the same password over and over. Because we use the same password because we don't want to remember a bunch of passwords. Well, let LastPass remember it for you, and then you can. LastPass will generate good passwords. That's the one I use, is LastPass. All my passwords are in it. It's encrypted with a single master password. It does a lot of smart things about encryption and salting as well. Does all the right things. So there's the password story. If you're an Evernote user, you should log on to your Evernote account on the web, and it will tell you, hey, you got to change a password. What's the new one? This would be a good time to download LastPass. It's free. The premium version's a buck a month, very cheap. Get the free version. Download it. Install it on whatever device, Mac, PC, Android, BlackBerry, iPhone, Windows Phone, Windows 8, everything. Create a good master password for LastPass. One you can remember, one that's not easily guessed, something that looks at least looks random. And start storing your passwords there. And this would be a good time to do that. Get LastPass, then go to Evernote, create a new password in LastPass, enter it into Evernote, and then remember it in LastPass. There you go. John in Temecula, you're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, John.
Hey, Leo. Thanks a lot for doing what you're doing. My brain is already full with just today's show, so I don't know how you do it. But
I dump it out of my brain so fill yours up so I can think some other thoughts.
Hey, look, I've got one question and then a quick follow-up softball question, I think, that you alluded to as far as Mac and PC. But my first question is, as succinctly as I can, over 6 years, I've been like a local volunteer photographer and videographer for a high school here in Temecula. And on my tower system with about six different drives, I've got a variety of photos. And the key thing here is videos. Now, I know about Picasa and photo organizers. My question is, and of course, all of this is meticulously organized, and I've kept track of that. Right, Leo?
In other words, you've got, like I do, a pile. It's just a pile.
I would say the best way to describe it is I'm 2 years ago or so, I just lost the bubble. Leo, and you know, it's
you gave up.
Drives and directories. I've got backups that I no longer need. So I really need to do three things. I need to find dupes and delete them. I need to find stuff that I want to keep, organize it. And then the third thing is store it out on the cloud. And the key is with videos, some of these files, highlight reels that I've worked on, et cetera, can be large.
Yeah, it's really not practical in most cases to put video on the cloud unless you have more bandwidth than God, because you got to upload them. And if a video is a, you know, if you have a terabyte of videos, it will take years to upload them. So don't do it. Nobody I know who is serious about video, serious videographer does that. What you'll do is you'll do it on hard drives and you'll get them off site. You still have to go off site, but uploading them is not practicable.
Okay, even with the FiOS, with the FiOS Quantum service, where I get a real quick pipe upload.
How big is what's your upload speed on your FiOS?
I'm getting 35 over 35, and of course Verizon has the new 75 over roughly 50.
So it's the upstream that matters. It's the upstream that matters because you're uploading, right? So
right.
Let's say you have 50 megabits per second. That's the top, right, for uploading. That's a lot, by the way. So,
right.
So
that's their new quantum service, yeah.
Yeah, hang on. I'm going to do some math, and you'll see why you cannot upload these. Hold on. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Math is a wonderful thing.
DSL Extreme Billboard.
A cool thing. So get off your ass, let's do some math, 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 math.
Yeah, I'm doing math.
3 minus 4 is...
-1.
That's right. And 6 times a billion is...
6 billion?
Nailed it.
John is a videographer. Nice thing he does. He volunteers for the local high school, takes photos and pictures and video for them. But he's now got a ton of video, and I'm trying to talk him out of online backup. So we just did a little calculation. I went to Wolfram Alpha. This is a great site, by the way. You can figure out. I was trying to figure it out by hand, and it's just you get lost with all those decimal points. So let's say, John, you got 50 megabits per second upload. That's an unusually high amount, like by a lot. But if you had 50 megabytes per second, a terabyte would take you a day, almost 2 days, 44 hours to upload, if nothing else were going on your internet connection at all. Now, if you had a much more reasonable, let's say you're Comcast and you've got 2 megabits per second, it would take a month and a half for a terabyte. Now, it's not unusual to have multiple terabytes. In other words, it's impractical to back up over the internet. Those really big files. Internet backups really for something under a couple of hundred gigabytes. But what all my videographer friends still will make, they'll to make copies. You still have to make backups. They just put it on hard drives. It's cheaper, too, by the way, in a way, because you just copy it over to a hard drive, and then they wrap them in bubble wrap, and they put them in a storage locker.
Okay, and so did you have a favorite file organizer that you like that stands out amongst the rest that I could rip through a bunch of photos and videos real quick and organize?
That's a good question. I use Lightroom, and many people use Apple's Aperture on a Macintosh's iPhoto. All of these will take videos in, but they don't have particularly good video organizing tools. So I would like to ask anybody in the chat room if they have a suggestion for a way to catalog video. Because I don't, that's a good question. I don't know. By the way, my producer, Chad Johnson, says, hey, you know, just upload them to YouTube.
Right. That's actually what I've been doing. So I'll hang up now, Leo, but the, you know, that follow-up question you alluded to, do you believe that that Apple has won the war? You know, as a videographer, I'm thinking about making the switch from CS6 and, you know, Premiere over to Final Cut Pro, and I've heard both sides of it. I would be curious to find out, especially with the Retina display, the higher resolution, what your opinion, you know, of this is. Has, you know, Apple won the war, and is it a good switch and something that you'd recommend? And thanks again for your show.
It's a great question. Thank you, John. And in fact, Apple had won the war back in the days of Cold Mountain, when Cold Mountain was one of the very first feature films to be edited in Final Cut. And I think a lot of people in Hollywood's eyes were opened. You mean you can do this kind of editing on a personal computer, a Macintosh, with relatively inexpensive software? Walter Murch, the editor of Cold Mountain, actually Apple was smart. They went to Walter Murch and said, "We would like to make it Final Cut into the Hollywood hands of Hollywood. Would you help us by using Final Cut to edit Cold Mountain?" And then just we'll have this feedback loop, and if something doesn't work, we'll fix it immediately. We'll like have a team assigned to you 100% of the time, and we'll make it the perfect product. And by the time they got to the end of Cold Mountain, poor Walter Murch probably was tearing his hair out, but he was using Final Cut. And I think that convinced a lot of people in Hollywood. I think the tide started to turn in the other direction just recently when Apple went from Final Cut Studio to their new Final Cut 10 that's downloaded from the App Store and is much stripped down, is not nearly as capable. A lot of pros said, whoa, what happened, Apple? You've abandoned us. And my friends in Hollywood tell me that there is a exodus back in the other direction to Avid, which was kind of the king of editors for a long time, and to Premiere. So it's hard to say who won the war, because the tide has shifted a little bit. We use a Final Cut Studio, the last big expensive version of Final Cut, here to edit our video. But we don't have very complicated needs. We didn't go to Final Cut 10 because we needed to support something called a SAN, and it didn't. It's my suspicion, frankly, that Apple no longer has the monopoly that they had for a few years in editing. But I don't know if they've lost, but they just don't have the monopoly. And I think the battle has shifted a little bit. Somebody in the chat room, Web 6008, says Disk Catalog Maker. That's a cataloging program, but it's not what you want. You want something that's going to be smart for video, that understands video better. And I'm not sure what a good choice would be for video. I'm not. We'll keep looking for you. Keep listening. John in Pittsburgh, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, John.
Hi, Leo. Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate it. It seems like you're my last hope, actually.
Uh-oh. Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
Exactly. I have a YouTube account with an inactive AdSense account.
Right.
And What happened was when I first set it up, I set it up on my Hotmail email. And then I compounded that problem by trying to set it up using my DSL Extreme email. And finally, I got a Gmail email and tried to hook it up with that. And I can't get into it to try to straighten it out.
And, of course, Google's support is non-existent.
Yeah, they're completely non-helpful.
Well, that, yeah. It's a free service. It's a free service. You don't get any support from Google and from YouTube. And if you screw up your YouTube account, you're kind of out of luck. What they wanted everybody to do is to tie their YouTube account to their Gmail account. I don't know what's going on. I mean, and I certainly have no strings to pull. I find YouTube as frustrating as you do. We have problems with them all the time. The easiest thing would be create a new account using your Gmail. You want to Google wants everybody to tie all their Google accounts together. I don't know if you had the account attached to something else and now you've changed the emails and Google has inactivated that account. All you can do is what you're doing, which is apply to Google and cross your fingers. I have no magic. I wish I did. Arthur in San Diego, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. How are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you, Arthur?
Every day is an adventure, I think.
That's true.
Let me take off speaker real quick, okay?
Okay.
Okay, you there?
Yep.
All right, I'll try to explain this the best I can. Years ago, I had a Dell. I still have it, but my friends were talking about, well, I downloaded a bunch of pictures, and what if your computer crashes and you need to back them up, et cetera. And I said, well, I'll just send them to my Yahoo Mail account. And, in case anything happens to my computer.
Yeah, you're backing them up in the email. That's a good idea.
All right. So I put them in a folder called Dad's Picks. Well, I got a new computer. I gave the Dell to my son, and I went on there, and I tried to open up the folder's still there. When I open it up, and the attachments are still there, but then it says the pictures are no longer here. It may be another computer or maybe another disk drive or some of this. I went to the old Dell, and I tried to open up there, and it's the same thing. And I'm like, well, what happened to my pictures?
But aren't they in your Yahoo Mail account?
Yes.
Well, that's why you sent them there. You backed them up.
Well, but they're not there now.
They're not in the Yahoo Mail? You logged on to Yahoo.com and looked there?
Yes, sir.
I have no idea. And I'm out of time. I'm 0 for 2. Leon Laporte, the tech guy. We'll take more calls right after this. I'm not much of a Jedi master. I'm afraid I've failed you. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo is the number. Last segment of the Tech Guy program. Carlene, next call. She's in La Habra, California. Hi, Carlene.
Hi.
Hey.
Thanks for taking my call.
Well, my pleasure. I'm sorry to keep you on hold so long.
Okay, I'm trying to upgrade my desktop because I've started my own business and I'm starting a website, and I'm going to give my old computer to my husband so he can look at his pictures. And I don't know which way to go, because one thing I've learned from listening to your show is that I'm a bit of a techno-tard.
That's not what you're supposed to learn from this show. I have failed again.
No, I've learned a lot, but I'm still a techno-tard.
Okay. Well, don't feel that way. If it's hard to use, it's because they didn't do a good job designing it.
The computer I have right now, it's a Dell, and I think I've had it probably 5 years.
Oh, yeah. Time to get a new computer.
Yeah. Sure. And, you know,
you're using Windows right now. Do you like it? Are you comfortable with it? You feel good?
Yeah, I'm using Windows XP.
Oh, golly.
Yeah.
Does it make you feel a little like you don't know what you're doing?
Maybe. But I'm afraid to go to Windows 8. I mean, I have used Windows 7. And I need some more time with Windows 7. I'm not even used to Windows 7.
Yeah. Well, the difference between Windows 8 and Windows XP is far greater than the difference between Windows 7 and Windows XP.
Yeah.
There's a huge leap because they've changed, really, how you get to settings, how you find things, what the start menu looks like. They've changed everything.
So that's why I'm a little afraid to go to Windows 8.
Well, but on the other hand, you could go to a Mac. Let me ask you what you do on the computer. What do you want the computer for?
Well, I'm mostly online.
Browsing.
I'm looking for things. I have suppliers that I download stuff to my website, and I have...
Oh, so you have a business, and it's online.
Yes.
Well, that sounds like you you probably need something pretty serious. Do you accounting on your computer?
No.
Any kind of line of business software you use?
No.
No, it's just browsing.
Not yet. Yeah, just and my website builder software where I get in and play around with my website.
Yeah. Okay.
I haven't even made my first sale yet.
Ooh, this is brand new business. Okay. And the website builder software is in the browser, right? It's just part of the browser.
Right.
So, yeah, that wouldn't matter then. You could use any computer.
Okay, but I've got several things open at one time going back and forth.
Yeah.
And I also have, like, Word and Excel open.
Well, now, I don't think you should fear Windows 8.
Okay.
It is very different. And I certainly talk to a lot of people on this show even who say, oh, gosh, I'm so sorry I went to Windows 8.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll give you the argument on the other side. It is the future of Windows no matter what people feel about it.
Right.
That's where Windows is going. It's gone. The bus has left.
And I'm looking for speed, you know, and I don't have a big budget. I'm looking at an Intel. I've done a little research online with like an Intel i5
3330. Yeah, that's about right. Yep, that's about right.
Okay, with about an 8 gigabyte.
You could do 4. You don't need more than 4.
Okay. At one of the big box stores right now, they have a really good deal on.
Sometimes a really good deal on a computer is a bad deal.
Yeah.
Because this is a business thing for you. I wouldn't get too cheap on it.
Okay.
A cheap computer is going to be less reliable. It's going to have problems that you won't have with a better computer.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, I think with Windows 8, you're going to really want a touch screen. A cheap computer won't have that.
Okay.
I would look, I think you would be very happy with a Dell XPS 1.
XPS 1.
It's not really cheap. It's a desktop.
You want
a desktop, yeah. Uh-huh. It's an all-in-one. It's basically Dell's response to the iMac.
Uh-huh.
So it's an all-in-one computer, 27-inch screen. I think they're beautiful. They're very well made. The Windows 8 versions have a touch screen. Now, they're not $200.
Yeah, right.
They're $1,300.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what you need to spend to get a good computer, and I think this is a good computer.
Okay.
You might even want to spend a little extra to get Dell's, gold support. The better support is considerably better than the free support.
Uh-huh. Would you go to Dell and build one yourself?
Well, I would start with the XPS 1, and then, once you select that, you can configure it as you choose.
Okay.
But I think the base model is fine.
All right.
I'll
check it out.
Yeah, I would look at that. This, to me, is better than going to a big box store and getting something cheap, to be honest.
Okay.
It's your business. Now, I know you haven't sold anything yet.
Well, no, I don't want to get too cheap, but, I mean, I was looking at a Dell. I know like a Dell or an HP with
Don't get an HP. Get a Dell.
Okay.
I like the XPS because I think it's attractive. It's easy to use. It's a big screen, and you'll see a big screen makes a big difference.
I'll go look at it.
Yeah.
I definitely will.
Yeah, I don't know if they'll have that to look at in the big box store. In fact, they probably won't.
Well, I'll go somewhere.
One of the problems with the big box stores is they don't usually sell the best of any manufacturer. They sell the one the manufacturer wants to move.
Oh, I see. Okay. Okay. That definitely helped me out then.
Yeah, I played with the XPS one and with Windows 7, was very impressed by the build, by the quality, by the features. And I think that the new touch screen. Now, make sure you get the new Windows 8 touch screen version.
Okay.
And you'll see why immediately. It's just a very natural way to work.
Okay. Cool.
All right. You could go to a Microsoft store. They'll probably have some choices. Vizio also has an all-in-one that's pretty good, and I think they have that at the Microsoft store.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Good luck. Thank you, Carlene. See, you're smart. You're smart. You know what you're doing. Let's see if we have time for one more call. David in Las Vegas, Nevada. Oops, that's not David. This is David. Oh, David in Las Vegas. Oh, I put that other one on hold. Oh, heaven, help us. Did you get? Oh, good. Okay. Thank you, Kyle. I had a button flurry. Hi, David.
Hi, Leo, long-time listener. Thank you for your show. Thank you for your recommendation. I went ahead and I went out and I bought a Epson Workforce WF3540 printer. And I got it at Best Buy, and I replaced it. I had an HP, and I got rid of that one. Anyways, my question is, through Best Buy, they want to give me, I guess it's an exchange type thing, $50 for 4 years. And I was wanting to know through Epson, they offer the tech support and everything for 2 years for $59.99. I was just wanting to run it by you.
Hey, I don't know who Best Buy uses. Is it Best Buy in-house or is it some third party like SquareTrade that does the support? That would be the question to ask. Who does the third-party support for Best Buy? And then look online and see how good they are. I'll be honest. I have two Workforce printers. I love those printers. I got exactly the same one. I have one at home and one at the office, and I've never needed tech support. They're great.
Okay, because they were saying that if anything goes wrong, that I can bring it back.
Get the Best Buy one. They're local. You know, if you get the Epson, you probably have to bring it to a depot or ship it back to them. Sounds like getting a local one's a good idea, but I think you're going to like that printer a lot. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. I'm Leo Laporte. Thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget, the Tech Guy is just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows now on the Twit Netcast Network, and you'll find them all at twit.tv. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on MacBreak Weekly, iPad on iPad Today. You get your daily dose of tech news from Tech News Today and our weekly roundtable show, This Week in Tech. It's all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next time with another great Tech Guy podcast. Thanks for joining me. See you next time.